You are listening to the lovely voice of Deva Premal, and it's time for Drishti Point on CFRO 102.7 FM. I'm Farhana Zarali, and we have a special guest today, Ted Kunz, author and psychotherapist, who is here to talk about bringing peace into your life. And I first heard him speak a couple weeks ago about his book, Peace Begins With Me. So welcome, Ted.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, it began 23 years ago with my son Joshua. And Josh was born healthy, and then at 5 months of age, we gave him his first vaccine shot. Josh reacted to the vaccine and had a seizure of about 25 minutes long. Took him to the hospital. They prescribed medication, sent us on our way, and suggested to us that if we just treated him as a normal child, that everything would be fine. But unfortunately, it wasn't fine, and Josh continued to seize. And over the next 4 years, those seizures increased in frequency, and by the time he was four, he was seizing 12 to 15 times a day. And each seizure was 15 to 20 minutes long, and a seizure of that length deprives the brain of oxygen, causes even more brain damage. And so this son of mine that could walk and talk and ride a tricycle and do all the things that a four-year-old could do, by the time he was four and a half, he could do none of those things. And so it began me on a journey, because I was an angry father. I was resentful. I was afraid. I was in despair. And it was a hard way to live life. And I finally made a decision that I needed to change all of that and made a commitment to do that.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciated about the talk that you gave is that you acknowledged and took responsibility for those feelings. And often I think when we hear about peace and meditation, we hear about the other side, the peaceful side, the blissful side. And we don't hear about the hard work that it takes to claim and take responsibility for those kinds of emotions. What was that like for you?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, is that was the big shift, is for me to finally take responsibility for that. I realize now that I had spent most of my life making other people responsible for my sadness, my anger, my despair, my happiness, my joy. And so I lived most of my life really out of control, powerless. And when people didn't behave the way I expected that they would, when I experienced sadness, I held other people accountable. And I think most of us live life that way. I hear the phrase, you make me happy, or you make me angry, commonly in our day-to-day language. And now I know that those statements are not true. And yet when we believe them, we give away our power over our own joy, our own peace, our own happiness.
Now that's something I'd like to return to. But I want to find out from you, was there a pivotal moment that really began your journey towards peace?
And there was this, well, let me tell you a couple of things that happened. In my despair, I went to see a psychic, and I had never done that before, but I was desperate for answers. Children's Hospital had just told us not to bring our son back. They said there was nothing else they could do. They had warned us that any one of the seizures could kill him, and so I was living in this place of chronic fear, and I needed to somehow grasp some truth about what was happening. And so I went to see this psychic, and the psychic was this old woman in Surrey. I don't even know how I got her name. And she invited me to come with my questions, and I only had one question, and the question was, will my son live? And I still remember her words. She paused, and then in this very clear voice, she said, "Have no fear. The son will outlive the father, as he should." And I remember when I heard those words, this joy went racing through my heart at the possibility that Josh would live. And a second question came to mind, and it was, well, if my son is going to live, what will he be when he grows up? And again, she paused, and in this very clear voice said, "Your son will be what he already is, and that is a teacher." Now, when I first heard those words, they didn't make any sense to me. Josh, by this point, had the capacity of a two-year-old, wasn't expected to improve. His language was reduced to about 40 words. And I couldn't understand how he could be a teacher. And I don't even remember if I asked more questions that day. I just remember leaving confused when I left the psychic. But what I did notice is that I began to get curious, and I began to wonder, well, if Josh is a teacher, there must be something he can teach me. And it seemed like once I was open to that possibility, the lesson started to come. And the first lesson, at least what I've called the first lesson, was a typical day in our home. Josh and I shared a little father-son ritual for years, where when I would come home from work, I would drive up the driveway, which was alongside of the house, and park the car at the back. And Josh would hear the sound of my car. He would know that it was Dad and that I'd come home, and so he would run to the window and wait for me to get out of the car. And when he saw me, he would yell, "Hi, Dad." And I would say, "Hi, Josh." And I would come into the house. But as his seizures began to increase in frequency, the times that he was at the window got less and less. And I hated seeing an empty window because I knew what that meant. It meant that he was having far too many seizures to be there. And on this particular day, I drove up the driveway as I did, and I looked to the window when I got out of the car, and there was his little face in the glass, his little nose pressed flat, and he had a big grin on his face, and he said, "Hi, Dad," and I said, "Hi, Josh." But I did something different that day, and I just looked at him, and I felt this sense of gratitude that he was well enough that day to be there. And while I was looking at my son, I heard this voice, and the voice was as if it was spoken out loud. And what I heard was actually a question, and the question was, when your son looks through the glass at you, what does he see? And I thought about that question, and I didn't like the answer, because what I came to realize is that he saw a father who was angry, a father who was afraid, a father who was in despair, a father who was resentful. But probably the answer I liked the least was that he saw a father who was rejecting his own son, because the truth was I didn't want this disabled son of mine. I wanted the son that was there in my imagination before all of this began. And so I remember making a commitment to Josh that day, and the commitment was, I'm going to learn how to be peaceful. I'm going to find my joy. I'm going to find my happiness. But I also decided I was going to learn to fall in love with the son that I have, not the son that I don't have. And so that was a pivotal point for me, and I began a journey that day to find peace, to find joy, to find happiness. And that's really where it began.
Now, it really strikes me, your honesty, because it must be hard to say those things about yourself, and to it takes a lot of courage, I would say, to be honest.
Well, it's amazing how much pain or how much courage you'll have when you're in pain. So I needed to learn to do something different. Life was too hard at that point.
And do you do you see gratitude as one of the things that can shift us?
That really was part of the opening, I think, is just being grateful for my son and again, learning to fall in love with him. And it took me a while to do that, because one of the things that I learned is that one of the strategies that I began to recognize that was important was where I placed my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that I was focusing my attention on all the things that my son couldn't do. And when I looked at Josh that way, it was a painful way to look at him. And it was actually Josh's grade 7 teacher that taught me to look at my son different. Can I tell you that story?
Please.
Yeah. The year that Josh was going into grade 7, there was enough students at his school for 2 grade 7 classes, and it just so happened that both of the teachers were men, and both were crazy about sports. And so they did something a little unorthodox as a way of dividing up the students for their class. And what they did was they flipped a coin, and then whoever won the coin toss got first pick. And then they alternated picks back and forth until all the students had been assigned to their respective classes. And so Jeff won the coin toss, one of the teachers, and he looked at this list of about 70 students. And after about 30 seconds, he chose my son with his first pick. And the other teacher was mystified, and he said, you know, I don't know all the kids on that list, but I know Josh. Josh is pretty hard to miss in this school. And he said, but I know that there's kids on that list that are smart, that are good-looking, that are great athletes, that are funny. And so tell me why you would choose a child that has an uncontrolled seizure disorder, that has the capacity of a 2-year-old, that needs to have all of his curriculum modified, that needs to be toileted. And Jeff was one of those people that saw my son different, and he said, well, let me tell you what I've noticed around the school the last couple of years. And he said, I've watched the kids, how eager they are when Josh comes into the school to push his chair to the class. I watch how they'll modify a game at recess or gym to include him in the game. I watch how they'll break his sandwich into small bites to make it easier for him to eat his lunch. I watch how they'll sit with him after a seizure and hold his hand or stroke his forehead and whisper in his ear and tell him that he'll be okay. And what I see is that they're kinder and gentler when they're around him. And so I think that if I have Josh in my class, it will make it a kinder and gentler place for all kids to learn. And so Jeff told me that story about November, and when I heard it, it just sent this shock right through my heart, because I realized I was more like the other teacher. I was the one who saw all the things my son couldn't do. And here was somebody telling me about what a gift my son was.
How interesting. Just those small things of, you know, shifting the way that we perceive the world, and everything shifts within our world.
As Gandhi said, be the change you want the world to be.
So I'd like to go back to a point you mentioned earlier about language. About the language of you make me angry or you make me happy, placing responsibility on another person, and the language of communicating feelings that come from yourself and taking ownership of that. So I feel rather than you.
Right.
But is language something that you deal with in the work that you do?
Absolutely. It's absolutely critical. See, language is the way that we tell our truth. It's the way we reveal who we are. And what I've discovered is that for most of us, we use language as a way of concealing, of hiding. And if you really want to build an intimate relationship, you need to reveal who you are. And so you've already described it, is that the most important thing is you need to talk about yourself. So you need to say, I think, I feel, I want, I desire. And what most couples do when they come into my office and they're conflicted is that you'll notice that they rarely make I statements. They almost always make you statements. And the word that causes the most fights in any couple relationship is you. When you say you did this or you did that or you didn't do that or you don't love me or you don't care about me. And so you is fighting words. I is an act of intimacy. It's an act of revealing what's inside. And you can't argue with somebody when they reveal what's inside of themselves.
No.
And intimacy is really what the word says, into me see, that you allow someone to actually see into you. And so it's not about sexuality. It's not about those things. It's about the act of allowing someone to see who you are.
Now that can feel very vulnerable.
Absolutely. And that means that you're telling your truth. That means that you're being intimate when you feel that sense of vulnerability. If it feels safe, it's likely you're concealing as opposed to revealing. And what I notice with couples is that when they first come together as a couple, when they're first dating, is that they make lots of revealing statements. They talk about what they love and how they spend their time and what's important to them and what their dreams are. And that's what attracts two people together.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they make this commitment to one another, once they stick a ring on each other's finger, then they often begin to conceal those things that might challenge that. You know, we make a vow that says, I'm going to love you forever. And so what I've noticed is that if something shows up in the relationship that might challenge that, we withhold it, we hide it, we conceal it, because we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to impact the relationship. And so with the best of intentions, we start to hide. And what I've discovered is that as you hide, you create a space between you and the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, the space gets bigger and bigger. And eventually what happens is you're not in a relationship with that person. They're not in a relationship with you, and it comes apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a paradoxical kind of way, by telling your truth, by being intimate, you actually deepen your relationship and you increase the likelihood that it will be a lifetime commitment. And so I often challenge couples to change the kind of vows they make to each other. Instead of saying, I'm going to be with you forever, instead they say, my commitment is I'm going to tell you the truth.
Mm.
And I believe through the act of truth-telling, we actually move towards a lifetime relationship. Whereas when we promise to be with somebody forever, we often conceal, which then creates distance.
Now, truth-telling is definitely something I want to return to, but I know it's time for us to take a short break. So we will be back. Those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Drishti Point, and stay tuned.
At the very outset, we have to know that truth is what it is.
Sahaja Yoga welcomes you to the exclusive premiere of the film Freedom and Liberation, documenting Shrimadaji's enlightened vision for humanity. Please join us at the Robson Square Media Center Thursday, March 20th. Doors open at 7 p.m. with the film at 7:30. For more.
Shanti, 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 oh. Shanti 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 Oh Om Shanti 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 Oh Om Shanti 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 Oh
Om Sahana Namavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviriyam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navatit Thomas Tumavit Nishavahai
Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviriyam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navatit Thomas Tumavit Nishavahai Together, let us progress and triumph. Let us gain energy and momentum. Lead us to clarity, feeling of unity. Let there be peace, peace, peace and wonder.
At the very outset, we have to know that truth is what it is.
Sahaja Yoga welcomes you to the exclusive premiere of the film Freedom and Liberation, documenting Shrimadaji's enlightened vision for humanity. Please join us at the Robson Square Media Center Thursday, March 20th. Doors open at 7 p.m. with the film at 7:30. For more information, visit freemeditation.ca.
Welcome back to Drishti Point on CFRO, also known as Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. You've just been listening to the music of Wade Imra Morissette from his album Strong as Diamonds, and that song was called Together. And for those of you who just tuned in, we're here in the studio with Ted Kunz, author and psychotherapist. And Ted, we were talking before the break about truth-telling. And we're so accustomed not to telling the truth in our society.
It's true.
You know, how does one learn how to tell the truth? Mm. And what's the truth about? What does it mean to speak one's truth?
Mm. No, I think that's a good point. Is I think there are very few role models for truth telling. And so it's not something that we're accustomed to. If anything, we're often discouraged when we're growing up and as little kids and we blurt something out about something, we're told, oh, that's not nice, be nice. And so we become silenced. And so it is a challenge. And the other thing that I see is that I believe that we have some confusion in our culture about who's responsible for each other's emotions. And so we often think that when we're in an intimate relationship that I'm responsible for the other person's happiness and they're responsible for mine. And I don't believe that that's true, but when we believe that, it means that we're often always trying to take care of them. And as a consequence, we withhold the truth as part of our caretaking.
Mm.
And so when you ask, how do we tell the truth? One of the first things, in order to be able to do that, we have to get clear about who's responsible for what. And so I got to a place of recognizing that I was 100% responsible for my thoughts, for my feelings, and for my behaviors. And so nobody can make me happy, and nobody can make me angry. I make me happy. I make me angry. And when there's some clarity about that, and when two people who come together in a relationship have that agreement, it really simplifies things. And so it makes it a whole lot easier to tell the truth when I don't feel responsible for how you respond to what I have to say. My responsibility is simply to tell the truth. Lovingly, respectfully, honestly, but that's what my responsibility is.
And how does that work in a context of a society where there are injustices? Because I think, you know, there are many situations in context of injustice or social inequality where the language is the government is doing this, or, you know, this is happening to us. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a mentality of victimization.
I would agree. There was a fellow that I did some work with many years ago, and one of the things that he taught me, he said there's a disease on the planet today that's an epidemic, and he called the disease victimitis, where we act like we're victims. And I began to recognize that we constantly give away our power to other people. And I'll see it all the time in relationships. It seems like the cultural wisdom is that, and in a relationship, each person is 50% responsible for what happens. And what I often say to them is that I would invite them to just experiment with the idea that each of them is 100% responsible for what happens, and that you don't give anything away to the other person. What you do is you say, if I created this, how might I have done that? What could I do different? And so what I've discovered is that when you take full responsibility, it's very empowering. And when you've got two people taking full responsibility, some amazing things happen. Because what we usually do is when we say, well, I'm 50% responsible and you're 50% responsible, then we kind of wait for you to make the first move.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see people sitting, twiddling their thumbs, waiting for life to be different as opposed to stepping into their power and actually creating a different relationship.
That's just it. It's a sense of empowerment. Mm-hmm. Stepping into your power, I think, that comes with the shift from you, them, to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the choices that I make.
I don't know if you've heard about this Hawaiian elder who name is Dr. Len.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a form of healing called Ho'oponopono.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked in the state mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he would treat his clients is that he would pull out their file and he would read through the file about all of the illnesses that this person had. And then he would assume that somehow he had somehow created this illness by his action or by the actions of his society. And he would meditate and reflect and pray about how he had created that illness. And the amazing thing is, through that action, his patients would get better. And they would get better without him even meeting them. And
really?
His effectiveness was so successful that they ended up having to close the state hospital because most of the people ended up being discharged. And it sounds like one of those urban legends, but if you go research it, which I've done, you'll find, in fact, that what I've said is true. And so it challenges our notion about responsibility and connection and separation and all those things in ways that I think it's beautiful for us to begin to explore.
Definitely. You know, I recently came to a realization myself when people ask a question, you know, people who believe in God, why did God create a world of so much poverty or injustice? But actually, it's humans that have created that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Collectively, we've created it. And so, again, we could wait for somebody else to be different. I mean, let's look at world peace. For a long time, I naively believed that world peace was going to happen because some leaders would make some good decisions. And now I realize it's not going to happen that way. The way it will happen is that I live peacefully in my own soul. I bring that into my intimate relationships. I bring that into my community. And through my being a peaceful person, I start to change those relationships. I teach peace by my way of being. And I believe that peace will happen because each of us grows peace from the ground up, from the inside out.
That's the title of your book, Peace Begins With Me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that there you have it, listeners out there. The way that we can move our world towards a more peaceful world is that we become more peaceful.
That's how I see it anyways. Yeah. And that's how I'm experiencing it. I watch beautiful changes happen. And I believe that when we enter a room, we can change the vibration of the room just by our way of being. That we're like a radio station sending out a signal. And the question is, what kind of signal do we send out?
Mm-hmm.
I attended peace rallies for years. And one of the things I noticed about peace rallies is lots of people at those rallies were angry.
Yes.
And I had to stop going to those because they didn't feel good. And my wish is that we would have peace rallies where we all come and our commitment is to be peaceful in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
That we send a signal of peace, we send a vibration of peace, that we grow that, and that we make a commitment to be peaceful every moment of every day. And I believe we're going to be more successful that way than thinking that we can get to peace by being angry.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's starting to happen. There are more public notices out there about meditation, healing meditations, mm-hmm. meditations for planetary peace, things of that nature. So I think there is a shift in how we're starting to view things.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm really hopeful about humanity. I've watched this growing consciousness happen in the last, I mean, it's been happening all along, but for me, I've really noticed in the last 5 years, people are open and hungry and receptive to it. When I first started sharing the messages out of my book, I was doing most of it with corporations, and I was always nervous that if I went into these corporate cultures and talked about peace, that they would throw me out the door. And I can remember about 5 years ago, I was in Calgary speaking, and one of the fellows in the audience stood up and said that he thought I was full of you-know-what, and that suggested that I was from a different planet, and maybe I should go back to the planet I came from. But amazingly, about 2 years after that, I was back at that in Calgary speaking to that same company, and the same individual was introducing me to everybody else, and I was a little apprehensive because the last time I met him, he thought I was a little crazy, and he stood in front of his peers, and he said, "I just want to let you know that this man changed my life." And what I've seen is that when people follow the ideas that I share, that they begin to live more peacefully, and there's a delight in that, a joy in that, and the people are grateful for the knowledge about how to do that.
Definitely. I definitely think we live and work in a world where we can benefit from finding that peace.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about some of the practices that you talk about in your book that help people to find peace within.
Well, one of the first things that I came to recognize is that I was responsible for all of it, and so I'm responsible for creating peace. I'm responsible for creating joy and happiness. And I began to recognize that the story that I told myself was absolutely critical, that we're always telling each other a story. And so the question is, what story am I telling myself? And so I learned to monitor my stories and to change my stories. And so, for example, one of the things that I recognize is that fear is always a story about what might happen in the future.
Hmm.
Fear is never about what happens now. We can always manage this moment. But what we can't manage is our imagination about what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I was using my imagination to imagine all the things I didn't want. Research tells us that the average North American thinks 9 times as many negative thoughts as positive thoughts.
Hmm.
And the other thing that research tells us is that the physical body doesn't distinguish between a real event and an imagined event. And so when you imagine all those negative things, you suffer. Well, you can do it the other way. You can use your imagination positively, creatively, intentionally.
So how does one do that? You know, I have a friend who is facing this exact dilemma that there are lots of situations she was imagining of how things could go wrong. And she was telling me she spent years of her life functioning in this pattern. And she's only recently realized that she's been torturing herself all mm-hmm. this time. So when does the change begin? And how does one start to work on that?
Well, the change begins when you take responsibility for the story you tell yourself. And then when you begin to take responsibility, when you start to realize that your story will create either joy or suffering, then you take responsibility for the suffering. And so when sadness happens, anger happens, despair happens, you say, okay, so I created that. So how did I create that? What's the story I told myself? See, I've learned to recognize that anger is always about holding on to a story that's not true.
Now that's a different, that's definitely put in a different way than I've heard before.
Mm-hmm.
So when we experience emotions that we're normally used to projecting onto others in terms of blame, like we are angry because so-and-so did something, and we take responsibility for that anger, and we ask ourselves what creates that anger, then that's where the shift begins.
That's right. So for example, I'm driving in my car, and somebody cuts me off, and I become angry. Now, we might say, well, he made me angry. Or we might say, my story made me angry. And my story was that he should have driven different than he did. Well, he drove the way he drove. And so I can have a story that said he shouldn't have done that. And I had all kinds of should not stories in my life. I had a story that said my son should never have been damaged by his vaccine shot. I had stories we should never have gone to war in Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan. The window shouldn't have been broken. The car accident shouldn't have happened. The Canucks should have won. I mean, and what I noticed was when I told myself those kinds of stories that were against reality, that I would suffer. I would feel angry or resentful. And yet the problem was is that I wasn't accepting reality. Reality is what is. What's the truth? The truth is what is. And I used to think that if I resisted reality, that it would change reality. Well, it doesn't change reality. It's already happened. It's already done. What it does is it changes me into somebody who's angry, frustrated, resentful, and despair. And so now when I drive my car, the story I tell myself is this is a high-definition video game. And when people come out of nowhere and I'm able to avoid a collision, I get 2 points for that. And so driving is actually a fun exercise because it constantly keeps you alert. And, you know, you never know when the next little challenge is going to show up. And so rather than it being an experience of frustration, it can actually be an experience of joy or stimulation or anticipation or whatever you want to create. I mean, we're the authors. We get to create whatever story we want to create.
And I imagine I suppose the imagination is really infinite in the possibility of stories it can create to really shift that perspective.
See, one of the things that I discovered is that humans have this ability that we actually think we're the only species on the planet that can do this. And we have the ability to assign meaning to life. And so life shows up, we assign a meaning to it, and then we have an experience. And the experience is dependent upon the meaning, not dependent upon life. So let me give you a simple example. I go golfing and I shoot an 80. And you might say, well, what experience will I have of that 80? Well, the question is what was my expectation? If I'm expecting to shoot a 65 and today I shoot an 80, I'm going to be disappointed, discouraged. I might think about giving up this crazy game. If I usually shoot 100 and today I shoot an 80, I'm delighted. I'm buying beers for everybody. I think about quitting my job and becoming a professional golfer. And so what I find interesting is the 80 is the same in both situations, but in one I experience anger and frustration and discouragement. And in the other, I experience joy, celebration, the possibilities. And so it's not the life that does that. It's the meaning that I assign. And so what I came to recognize is that I would regularly assign meanings to life events that would cause me to suffer. And many of those meanings were meanings that had been handed to me by others or turning on a TV or opening up a newspaper or radio and taking on somebody else's meaning. And one of the shifts for me actually happened a number of years ago. I read an article in a parent magazine, and the author's name was Michael Warren, and the name of the article was, "Who Tells the Stories That Our Children Hear?" And Michael talked about how in Native tradition and in previous times that elders would sit down with little people and they would tell them stories. And embedded within the story was the knowledge or the wisdom or the values that they wanted that child to take on.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael asked the question, who tells the stories that our children hear today? And when you think about who is the primary storyteller of children today, it's
television.
It's television.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with television is that the storytellers are usually people we don't know,
mm-hmm.
and in many cases don't even share our values. And yet we've handed over the responsibility to storytelling to these strangers. And so Michael says to parents, take back that responsibility. Be the storyteller for your children. And I think we need to take that personally as well. We need to become our own storytellers. Stop giving it away to somebody else.
Lots to think about there. We are going to take a very, very short break while I look for music here. And actually, we're going to play some more Deva Premal because it is International Women's Week here at Co-op Radio. And because we had this interview scheduled quite some while ago and I couldn't I didn't want to change it, to be honest. I was really looking forward to it. I thought, well, maybe I can just play some music that is sung by a woman and that will satisfy our listeners out there. So you are going to listen to Deva Premal from her album Love is Space. And this is actually, the track is the last words of the Buddha before he passed on. And the translation of the song that you're listening to, Gate, gone, gone, gone beyond. The last words of the Buddha is recorded in the Heart Sutras, and that's sung by Deva Premal. And just because it's such a lovely song, I'm going to keep it in the background for us. So we're back in the studio. You're listening to Drishti Point on CFRO, also known as Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. And we're here with Ted Kunz, psychotherapist and author of Peace Begins With Me. And I think we have time for one last question. And I was going to ask you a question, but now I think that there's a better thing I can do, and that is ask you if you have any words that you'd like to leave us with, any thoughts, considerations, insights.
Well, I think my invitation to your listeners would be to explore the possibility that they're incredibly creative beings and that they actually can create their life, they can create their experience. And so instead of living life reactively, as at least I did for 40 or more years, experience each moment as the opportunity to create. I believe that one of the most joyful things that we do is create, and when we consciously create, it's even more joyful. And I believe that we can create every moment. So it's about waking up in the morning and saying, what do I want to create today? And what I've discovered is that most of my creative energies is focused on ways of being as opposed to what I will do. And so it's not what will I do today, it's about how will I be today? Will I be peaceful? Will I be joyful? Will I be loving? Will I be forgiving? Will I be grateful? I'm sure you've heard the expression that we're human beings, not human doings. And so it's a good reminder to move us into our place of being. And we were talking in the break about just about being present, about giving permission to do one thing at a time, just instead of multitasking like our computers do, and I'm glad my computer can do that, is giving ourselves permission to be in one place at a time and be there fully. Embrace it, enjoy it, take all of life out of it, of that moment.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
And for people who want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
I have a website. It's peacebeginswithme.ca. I also have a monthly peace newsletter that I do each month that I tell some stories or share some wisdom. It's a free newsletter, so if they come to my website, it's on the homepage. There's a sign-up link. And my news is that I'm in the process of having my book turned into an audio book, and I think it should be ready in about a month's time, and I'm looking forward to that.
Very exciting. And actually, for anyone who calls in just after we finish the show, I'll be here at the station for another 15 minutes. And if you call in to the station, and the phone number is 604-684-8494, you can receive a free copy of Peace Begins With Me, the book or the DVD that Ted has graciously donated to our show. So please call in the next, after 10 minutes or so, 604-684-8494. Ask for Drishti Point, and we'd be happy to help you with that. And before we hand off the reins to the next show, to The Rational, which is up next, just a few announcements. Jerry Devoyne, whose music we often play on the show, is having his Wisdom of the Voice, Healing Voice, Sacred Sound workshop. And that's happening on Sunday, March 9th from 10 to 5 p.m. You can email info@healingvoices.net. And it's a dynamic workshop which includes throat overtone singing, breath work, Ayurvedic healing sounds, sound healing techniques, universal sacred sounds, mantras and meditation, singing from your heart, and I love this, lots of laughter. And
I did some work with Jerry. He's a master with the voice. It's pretty remarkable.
He is. You know, this is one of the few shows that we haven't played his CD, but we normally start with it. And we're actually interviewing him in spring, in April. So those of you who haven't heard of Jerry Devoyne or have and would like to hear more, you'll have to tune in April. And he's also holding an event called Sacred Journeys, a Healing Sound Bath. That sounds wonderful. The One Voice Harmonic Choir, Wednesday, March 5th at the St. George's Chapel. And again, email info@healingvoices.net. And the number for both of those is 604-872-7117. And Snowy Owl Productions presents an International Women's Day concert honoring our grandmothers, and that's happening on Saturday, which is International Women's Day. St. Andrew's Wesley Church at 7:30. You can get tickets from Ticketmaster outlets. And it's a benefit for the Downtown Eastside Center for the Arts. And our last announcement is about Kirtan. And details of the Kirtan: Give Peace a Chant, call and response chanting and sacred sound vibrations every Friday night at 7:30 at Yoga Sukho Studio, which is on 16th and Arbutus. And you can look up the website givepeaceachant.org. So thank you so much for being with us here today, Ted.
Thank you.
I'm really excited for the listeners who will get to read your book, and I'm sure that we'll hear lots of great feedback from that. And it's really been great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Drishti Point, and stay tuned. We'll be here next Monday, 5 to 6, and we're here every Monday. CFRO 102.7 FM. Looking to read some of the words of Ted Koons and read his book Peace Begins With Me, call us now at 604-684-8494. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everybody. It's 6 o'clock here at Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. You're listening to The Rational, and this is your host, Adam Carmichael. As we have every first Monday of the month, Yasmin's international news segment. So I'm going to pass it over to her and take it away, Yasmin.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of International News from the perspective of international newspapers here on The Rational, 102.7 FM CFRO. I'm Yasmin Azarpashu, joining you this evening live from our studios in downtown Vancouver. Tonight we'll be looking at the editorial pieces published in the British Guardian Weekly last week that includes writer Gary Young's take on analyzing the role of superdelegates in the U.S. Democratic and Republican primaries, Jonathan Steele's critical look at the political state of Somalia and Kenya, and the political role of Beijing Olympics by Simon Jenkins. We'll start with Gary Young's article with the headline, Democrats Must Show Belief in Democracy. In December, the president of Uzbekistan, Islam Karimov, stood for re-election. Karimov, a one-time ally in the War on Terror, who in 2002 had one opposition leader boiled alive, has long faced criticism from human rights groups and the UN. Having already served two terms, he has not even been eligible to stand. A minor detail for a man like Karimov. His three opponents all endorsed him and did not ask Uzbeks to vote for them. Those who would not endorse him were disqualified and imprisoned. Karimov won the day with 88.1% of the vote. There's a profound difference between holding an election and having a democracy. Elections are the best means that we have for giving people a voice in the running of their affairs. Democracy is the system that ensures that voices are heard by empowering them with the ability to change those who run our affairs. Elections, in and of themselves, are a purely technical matter. The authorities name the day, tell the voters, provide the boots and the equipment. The voters make their choice. The authorities then tally the results. But as we know from countless examples from Kenya to Florida, the technical leads effortlessly into the political. Which day? Which voters? Where are the booths? How does the equipment work? Who's counting? Whose votes count? All this has a bearing on the result. That's why democracy, if it's working, gives us the right to kick out the authorities. Since the beginning of January,